So just a couple things before I start, just to share. One of my favorite things about retreat over the years, it's developed even more, is loving the sound of the settling. Anybody else like that? I just think it's fun to listen to it, especially if you get here early and you close your eyes. You just listen to the kind of excitement, and then there's a settle. Finally, it settles. Just fun to listen to. I was also curious how many of you saw the Family of Deer. Wasn't that so cool? For those of you who didn't see it, I'm sorry. Maybe they'll come back, but it was a little bit like paradise here, right? It was a little, there were butterflies and bunnies, and then there were this family of deer, and there were three little ones, and they were just jumping around and playing and didn't seem afraid of us at all. It was just beautiful. Nobody wanted to walk past them to disturb them. But it also occurred to me that how interesting it was to be in paradise, if you will. Like, all the conditions are really beautiful here, and yet, what can be going on in the mind sometimes, right? We're missing paradise. It's kind of interesting. So those are my observations as I'm sitting here. But I wanted to start out tonight's talk by sharing a story with you. And I know that some of you have been on this particular retreat with me before. I've heard this one maybe a couple of years ago. So I hope you can hear it in a new way. So about 4 years ago now, just a few days before I was about to leave for a longer retreat that I'd planned for a while, one of my very best and dearest friends, who was also my retreat manager at the time, discovered one evening that she had a brain tumor, and the next morning she was gone. She passed away. And it was, she was my age. It was a complete shock to everyone she knew, and her husband and her children, her family and everyone. You know, she was in her early 50s, full of life, one of the kindest, sweetest, most compassionate people I've ever met. And her funeral happened pretty quickly. And instead of staying home, which is always highly recommended, you know, I usually screen who signs up for my retreats to make sure they're not experiencing some recent trauma or grief or loss. You're really not supposed to go, you know, when that's happening. But of course, in my mind, it was like, you know what? I teach this stuff. I've got this, right? I'm okay. I'm different. And, right? And so I thought the way I rationalized it was, you know, it's really going to be a good time for me to get quiet and, you know, spend some time thinking about and grieving my friend. And a retreat sounds like a perfect time to do that. And of course, once I got there, what I realized almost immediately was that what I really deeply needed and wanted was companionship and someone to talk to and hold me and offer me empathy. And of course, I had literally no one to talk to. Just like you all are doing, I was literally required not to talk to anybody. And the only contact I would have for a teacher once a week on this longer retreat was 15 minutes a week with a teacher. So at first, one of my biggest lessons on that retreat is expressed very beautifully by Ram Dass, which is you need to learn to keep your heart open in hell. Because that's really what it felt like, right? Felt like hell. How do I keep my heart open in hell? And of all the retreats I've ever attended, this was definitely, I would say, the most difficult, but probably also the most fruitful. And those of you who've been on retreat know, honestly, the most difficult, challenging retreats are often the most beneficial and fruitful. If they're blissful, that's nice, but then there's sometimes not a lot of transformation. So in essence, what those 2 weeks turned out to be was a kind of intensive boot camp in self-compassion, because literally I had no one else to give it to me. It was boot camp. Nobody else. I couldn't ask for empathy or compassion from anybody but myself. I was stuck with myself. And in the end, of course, it turned out to be just an amazing gift. But you know, at the time, it didn't feel like that at all. Afterwards, of course. One of the teachers on that particular retreat, the former German monk Akichno, reminded me of this in one of his talks that he was giving. He just simply said, mindfulness doesn't always feel good. Mindfulness doesn't always feel good. And honestly, that's the truth, and it's not supposed to. As the Buddha taught in the First Noble Truth, we're human. And so inevitably, we're all going to experience dukkha, suffering. You know, it's inevitable. The teacher Joseph Goldstein, the great teacher Joseph Goldstein, uses another less intense word than suffering because that just seems so heavy. He uses the word disappointment. And I kind of like that better. If you think about it, everything you're suffering, everything you're struggling with, there's some sense of disappointment, frustration, right? And it includes, this word disappointment includes almost all the difficult emotions that we experience, right? Disappointment with situations, with other people, with life the way we want it to be, and especially disappointment with ourselves when we don't seem to be living up to our own expectations, which is often, right? And yet whenever we're experiencing pain and disappointment for whatever reason, you know, because we're human, there's a really strong tendency to make it the suffering, the disappointment, the pain, and therefore ourselves wrong. Isn't there? Right? And so even after all these years of practice, 3 decades of practice, I found myself doing that yet again on this longer retreat. It's a really tricky habit. And it's a habit. It's just a habitual way of relating. So just for instance, even though I know intellectually up here that experiencing a sense of guilt is a natural part of the grieving process, I was kind of beating myself up ruthlessly about this in my solitude. And I had a gigantic case of what I like to call the shoulds, which basically are shoulds whenever you catch them. I was telling my group this today. Whenever you can catch a should in the mind, I should, they should, you know, he should, she should, it's toxic, okay? And so it's really good practice to be mindful of these. So my particular shoulds on that retreat included things like, I should have recognized that my friend's headaches during those last 6 months were a sign of a brain tumor. She was having a lot of headaches. She also had a lot of allergies. I mean, I didn't know, but I had the shoulds. You know, I should have known that. I should have urged her to go to the hospital immediately and have that checked out, or the doctor. And of course, I was going through all the things in my head that I hadn't done perfectly with my friend. I shouldn't have done that. I shouldn't have said this. I can't believe I did that. That one time we'd been friends for a while. And I was, as they say, shoulding all over myself. It's a good way to remember it, right? And because of all the judgments I had, all of my toxic shoulds, the biggest obstacle that I was that I was believing that I was somehow undeserving of my own compassion. I was undeserving of my own self-compassion. And of course, we tend to do this with other people as well, don't we? You know, we tend to deem certain people or even whole groups of people as worthy or unworthy of our compassion or our empathy, depending on whether or not we think they're deserving of this, right? And so because I was doing this to myself and not allowing myself my own compassion, what I ended up doing was using my thinking mind, doing my best to use my thinking mind to talk myself out of my grief, trying to fix it. Anybody do that? I can just think my way out of this pain, you know, talk myself out of it. So I was tricking myself by trying to use all the tools of my practice as a kind of defense from the pain. So check out when you're doing that. Right? When you're using your practice as a defense to just feel it, you know? And what I recognized later was that, of course, at the time, it was so soon it was so big, it was so new that there was really on my part a complete unwillingness to be with the reality of it. I was still in the denial stage, I think. But that inability or unwillingness to want to be with it is in so many ways the opposite of compassion. Not being willing to be with the pain, yours or another person's. And you might just consider for a moment, you know, whenever you're feeling grief or sadness or you're angry or shameful or disappointed, who do you really want to be with you? Who do you want to be with you? You know, is it that anxious person who showers you with solutions? That person? Right? Is it the frustrated person who blames you in some way? Right? Is it someone who maybe yells at you or tells you you should stop being sad, stop being angry, stop being shameful, stop it, right? Or worse, tells you you shouldn't be upset. You shouldn't be angry. How does that one go over, you know? Or is it that person that simply leans forward, gives you a warm, kind smile, and just listens and nods their head, maybe rests their hand in yours, maybe, you know, sets their hand on your shoulder while you cry, right? Or maybe that person who just hands you a tissue as snot is running down your nose and laughs with you and just simply holds you, right? So with that kind of person, right, that kind of listener, there's no fixing involved, no fixing. And there's definitely no judging. It's just a kind of pure, gentle, kind presence and a warm heart that's simply with you. I'm right here, you know, completely allowing whatever you're feeling, all those difficult emotions without judgment, okay? So that person is empathizing with your pain, not from being at a place that's above, right? But from a place of, I can see and sense how painful this is for you, and I so wish that you weren't going through this. It's my deepest wish that you were not suffering in this way. I care about this suffering. And I want it to end. It's my deepest wish for that to end. I care about it. And this is exactly what we want to do, of course, for ourselves, right? And it's the very essence of compassion, karuna, which is the second of the Brahma Viharas. Okay? So karuna is what metta or friendliness feels when it encounters suffering. It simply wants the suffering to stop without judging who is suffering. It's not conditional. You know, compassion is not conditional. The Zen philosopher Erlich Hutchinson says it this way. Love is being able to view a situation without adding duality to it. Okay. And when true compassion is present, it allows our kind of constant defensiveness to finally relax. And we can begin to just open up to what's right here, our defenses, right? The teacher, Frank Ostaseski, who I love, who say a little metta prayer for him. He's fine, but he just had a stroke. Those of you who might know Frank, he wrote the 5 Invitations, FYI. Really fantastic book. He says, when our defenses are down, we can look objectively at our situation and see the true origins of our suffering. Then we can intervene skillfully to address the real causes, not just the symptoms. So I'm going to read that again. When our defenses are down, we can look objectively at our situation and see the true origins of our suffering. Then we can intervene skillfully to address the real causes, not just the symptoms. Okay. So as Pat was saying last night, the Buddhist texts describe compassion as a quivering of the heart in response to the recognition of suffering. And so compassion is in fact a verb. It's a doing. It involves a movement of the heart. Okay, that's why it's a quivering. There's a movement of the heart. And it really involves asking our hearts, what's the most compassionate thing to do here? I want this suffering to stop, so what's the most compassionate thing I can do here? Not fixing it, right? It's that impulse within us to jump directly into the river when we see that people are drowning. We don't need to personally know who the people are or judge whether they're worth saving or question their motives for being in the water in the first place. We jump in because they're suffering. There's no thought in it. You know, it's only our heart responding directly to wanting the suffering to stop. We're not judging it. In the very same way, compassion does not include a kind of selfish wish to help someone to stop suffering so that we will feel more comfortable. That's a really common one. It's hard. And this is a common way that we close off our hearts when we feel somehow uncomfortable with someone else's suffering. And in this case, what happens is that instead of compassion, what we're really offering, again, is an attempt to fix so that the problem will go away. It's a form of aversion, really. I want you to stop crying. I want you to stop doing whatever you're doing. I want your problem to be fixed because it's making me feel uncomfortable. That is not compassion. What we're saying in essence when we're trying to fix is, I am unwilling to be with your suffering or pain because in some way I consider it wrong or it shouldn't be, right? And of course, you can think about how often we do this with ourselves, don't we? Right? Judging our own pain as somehow wrong, something that needs fixing because it's making us feel uncomfortable. It shouldn't be. It's wrong. So our practice is actually asking us to do the exact opposite, which is to courageously open our hearts to suffering unconditionally, without conditions. This is why the practice is so hard. This is the courageous aspect of it. And when we can do this, what we begin to recognize more and more is the truth of the first noble truth, which is that everyone suffers, all of us, and that as sentient beings, we are all united in our suffering and in our wish to be happy. Both, aren't we? That's what unites us, doesn't it? Our wish to be happy and our suffering. My favorite Buddhist nun, Pema Chodron, tells us, sorrow has the exact same taste for all of us. The exact same taste. And so we all experience and feel grief and anger and envy and joy in the same way. It's not my grief, it's the grief. Right? It's not my anger, it's the anger. But so often we, you know, whenever we think about offering our compassion, our tendency is to be a bit selective and limited about who we're offering this to. Think about it. It's just honest. We're just honest with ourselves. We can say that, right? So we forget the truth of our inner connection and tend to judge people as either worthy or not worthy of our compassion. So for instance, it might be really easy, of course, for us to offer our compassion to our beloveds, to our friends and family and people we find easy to love. That's not hard, right? It might also feel really easy to offer our compassion to those who are in obvious pain or suffering in ways that seem extreme to us. But it's often so much more difficult to offer it to those who seem to be enjoying what appears to be good conditions in life, maybe very good conditions in our eyes. And of course, it's especially difficult to offer any compassion to those who we feel are engaging in harmful actions. And yet, given all of that, the person we tend to find the most difficult to offer our compassion to is who? Yeah. Isn't that true? Right? We tend to judge ourselves more than anybody in the whole world. You know? But again, as the Buddha so wisely taught us, you can search throughout the entire universe for someone who is more deserving of your love and affection than you are yourself. And that person is not to be found anywhere. Right? So whenever we ourselves are in pain, we are as in much need of our compassion as anyone else. We are equally deserving of our compassion. And so in order to start to deepen our capacity for compassion for others, we first need to become aware of the suffering in ourselves. This is really our practice. We start with ourselves, as with all the rest of the Brahma Viharas, with all of the practice, we start with ourselves. Again, to quote Pema Chodron, she tells us, in order to have compassion for others, we have to be compassionate for ourselves. In particular, to care about other people who are fearful, angry, jealous, overpowered by addictions of all kinds, arrogant, proud, miserly, selfish, mean, you name it. To have compassion and to care for these people means not to run from the pain of finding these things in ourselves. Yeah. And so often the very first step is to realize that we're suffering in some way, right? To recognize it. And this part, by the way, it's really sometimes really difficult to just that first aspect to say, oh, you know what? I'm in pain here. I'm suffering in some way. I'm struggling. You know, many of us have been conditioned culturally to care more about the suffering of others than ourselves. And so sometimes we don't even recognize that we need our own compassion. It always surprises me when someone's struggling and I ask them, how have you been compassionate to yourself? It's like a shock in the eyes. Something didn't even think about being compassionate, you know, to themselves. Right? So whenever we can recognize that we're struggling with a difficult emotion or situation, or maybe a sense of failure, we can use some simple affirmations to help us to reconnect to a sense of kindness and compassion. Really helpful to have in your pocket. Okay. And I use these, by the way, all the time still. I have people in my Sangha who are here know I have sticky notes and I use them. I utilize them in like places I'll see them in my office or my restroom because it's great mind training. Okay. So the first is a deep recognition of our suffering. And this is from Sylvia Borstein, the teacher. And I love this. Kind of brings me tears every time I hear it or say it, which is simply, sweetie, you are in pain. Sweetie, you are in pain. It's brilliant because it's just, it's simple. It's a recognition. It's a not fixing. And it's just kind, isn't it? Just immediate, sweetie, you're in pain. Which is followed by, the rest of her quote is, relax, take a breath, let's pay attention to what's happening, and then we'll figure out what to do. Relax, take a breath, pay attention to what's happening, and then we'll figure out what to do. So that's one, sweetie, you're in pain. Another one is from another of my teachers, Tara Brach. That's where I learned it from her, is I care about this suffering. I care about this suffering. And again, you recognize it's not my suffering. It's this suffering. Okay, because it connects you. I care about the anger that is passing through me as it passes through others. Right? This frustration, this anger, this despair. I care about this despair. Another way we can work with this is by bringing a sense of gratitude, actually, for the difficulty. You know, I've always been taught to bow to it. We bow to the difficulty for the opportunity to learn and transform. And with this one, the other affirmation is, may this suffering serve awakening. I love that one. May this suffering serve awakening. It depersonalizes it a bit. It's an affirmation for awakening. So that's the first step, to simply recognize that we're in pain in some way. And the second is to courageously allow ourselves to feel what we're experiencing, to really get to know it, so that we know what it feels like and looks like, not only in ourselves, but in others. We want to recognize these difficult emotions. We don't want to block ourselves out from them, right? And that's the paradox of this practice. So through our practice, we can really begin to understand compassion by learning to become a kind, calm, non-judgmental, compassionate presence for ourselves with all of our human flaws and struggles. That's how we learn. And so we really need to learn to be a compassionate listener for ourselves. And again, this is how we practice. Practice listening to our own pain so that we are able to do that for others. We're not going to learn unless we learn how to do that for ourselves. So instead of judging or blaming or trying to fix, trying to get rid of or running away from our suffering, we can begin to learn to become for ourselves, again, that kind, non-judgmental person that we really wish would be with us when we're in pain. So, for instance, we learn to hold ourselves in our pain or our fear with great kindness and care. We let ourselves know that however we're feeling, it's not wrong. It's completely okay. Not wrong. That we're right here for ourselves. We're not going anywhere. We're not abandoning ourselves, right? And, you know, we're not going to run away. We're not going anywhere. That can be hard. How often do we run away from ourselves, abandon ourselves? That part can be hard. So this often sounds so simple, but as most of us who have practiced it knows, you know, practicing self-compassion takes a huge amount of practice and patience and courage to do it. You know, people who are on this path are called warriors in the Mahayana tradition, warriors. And this is because it's asking us to go against our instincts and not look away, not run away, not look away. You know, to be fully present and touch in with our own pain, as well as the thoughts and the behavior that is fueling the discomfort. In the words of author and Buddhist scholar Joanna Macy, we are learning to sustain the gaze. Sustain the gaze. Or as Rumi urges us, don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That is where the light enters you. Right? I love that quote from Rumi. That is where the light enters you. And so this is exactly what this practice is asking us to do, to not turn away, to be willing to sense into our own pain and another's pain as if it were our own, because truly it is. It is, you know. Which is another thing that this practice is asking us to recognize, which is that we're not separate. And that this feeling of being separate is our deepest wounding. Isn't it? I mean, it's tearing our country apart right now. This feeling of being separate from everything, from the planet, from each other. It's our deepest wounding. And so this not turning away part is the part that takes our strong, conscious effort, because it's our natural instinct to want to run or to numb it out or ignore it or pretend that it doesn't exist. La, 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 you know. And some of us have the privilege of doing that more than others, right? La, 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 la. And as a writer, I like to remember that the letter A in the word allow, that it has a sharp point. It's pointy, right? And so that allow, the A, if you think of the A, we want to jump over the A because we don't want to get stabbed by it. Because, right? We want to avoid the hurt. I don't want to feel that, so I'm going to jump over, right? And this never works, by the way, right? Many of you know the RAIN practice: recognize, allow, investigate, and then rest in natural awareness. Well, we go from recognize to investigate. How can I fix it? We roll our sleeves up. Nobody wants to touch the allow because that part hurts, right? It's hard. It's the hardest part. And that's where the compassion comes in. The A is the compassion, to feel it. And so whenever we recognize that we ourselves are struggling or suffering, because that's where we start by allowing ourselves to consciously drop out of the thinking mind and courageously be with our feelings and the actual physical sensations in the body and in the heart, which are unpleasant, right? So just as a, for example, on that 2-week retreat I was on, this meant beginning to notice and allow this gripping and tightening squeeze at my heart and my throat. There was a heaviness in my body that felt like I was full of boulders, like just rocks. It was heavy. I was deeply bone tired, just exhausted, tired. And there was also a sensitivity and a kind of anxiousness, right? All of that. And so you might think of this allowing yourself to experience all of that as a kind of holding, right? The way you might hold a child who is crying and afraid. Maybe that child is crying and afraid because they believe there's a monster under the bed, right? You don't berate the child for crying or for being afraid, right? Or tell them that they're wrong or they're crazy or they're stupid. There's no monster under the bed, right? You simply hold them and tell them, it's okay, I know you're afraid. I'm right here, it's okay. Isn't that how we do it? Yeah, or how we should do it? Right? This is how we allow with compassion. And when we can do this, this compassionate, what I like to call compassionate allowing, it can invite a kind of deep letting go sometimes, as it did with me on that retreat. Deep letting go. I ended up going for a really long walk in the woods, and I found this big, gigantic rock was hidden where I could just sit down and sob. And I did for about, it must have been hours. I just left the retreat center and went and just sat on this rock. And I literally sat with my grief. That was how I sat with my grief. I sat out in the woods on a rock for 2 hours and just cried. And again, here you might recall, again, Sylvia Boorstein's suggestion of how we practice the allow part. We relax, take a breath. We pay attention to what's happening. We could stop there. And then we figure out what to do. We usually have it the opposite way, don't we? Let me figure out what to do, and then maybe I'll get around to feeling what's actually happening in here. So in the very same way, after those many hours of allowing myself to just feel the pain of it, and my defenses had finally dropped, then I could start questioning what I was believing. And this mostly meant questioning my shoulds, questioning them, okay? But we don't start with that. And, you know, it's again that, like, that idea of a child who is frightened by the monster. Once the child is finally, you've held it, and the child has calmed down a bit, then you might start asking some gentle questions like, you know, maybe, what are you afraid of? Very gentle. What are you afraid of? Or, why do you believe there's a monster under the bed? Why are you believing that? So with our practice, we can be that same kind, compassionate listener and ask our feelings the same question. So again, this is not an intellectual process, okay? We're not going to the thinking mind, which actually lies to us a lot. We want to drop out of the analytical, judgmental mind and go directly to the feelings themselves. So for instance, we ask our hearts, feeling, what are you believing? Go here. Don't go up here. Drop down. Go into the heart. Feeling, what are you believing? Feeling, what do you need? That can be a good question. What do you need? Feeling. Don't ask this what it needs. That has a, whew, that could go on for hours. Don't do that. And, you know, like that compassionate, wise person who's with the frightened child, we can even take our own hands, if you will, and gently show ourselves that the monster isn't real, you know. We can start to more clearly recognize the beliefs that are fueling our suffering are not necessarily true, even though the feelings themselves are completely real. The beliefs are not true, okay? And so, for instance, on my retreat, as I continued to sit for those several weeks with the full pain of my grief and touched it and held it and let it be without trying to fix it, without trying to change it, or offer commentary or solutions about it, there was a voice while I was meditating that arose in me, and it simply said, it kind of came out of nowhere. It said, please don't abandon me. Please stay with me. It was almost desperate. Please don't abandon me. Please stay with me. Each time I found myself pulled away from the present moment into the dream world of thought, the voice would come back. Please don't abandon me. Please don't do it. Until finally, more and more, I would just be willing to stay. And I had agreed to not abandon myself. And what happened was that as I did this more and more, the tightness and defensiveness of my body started to thaw and open. And the pain itself became kind of warm. And the feeling became warm. And there was kind of a flood of tears. And the breathing slowed. And finally, there was just sort of a warm, glowing, loving kind of peacefulness that happened. So in surrendering to the pain and giving up the fixing, what I recognized is that there's so much pain in this world, so much judgment and jealousy and disappointment. The only thing left is compassion, right? That's what remains. It's love. All the world's teachings, including the Buddhist teachings, point to this. You know, in the end, what matters is that there's love. There's an acceptance of our flawed humanness. It's the Jesus died for our sins, or God loves us unconditionally. That same sentiment. So what we're training ourselves to do over and over is to love ourselves without any conditions or requirements, without any shoulds. And as we learn more and more through this practice how to do this, what happens is that love inevitably starts to flow out to others. It's that sense of, let me be love. Let me merge with that. Let me be love rather than needing love. Let me be that, you know? And as we practice opening our hearts to the pain, the inevitable dukkha, that much more we open our hearts to connection with all things and discover that exquisite joy of not feeling separate from anyone or anything in this world, okay? And we become more and more confident that we can not only give that to ourselves, but to others. Through this practice, over and over, we become more confident in that. The teacher Ram Dass, again, describes it so beautifully this way. He says, when somebody comes to me and they're suffering deeply, My first experience is one of empathy with their pain. My heart hurts. Then, as my mind quiets, I start to experience expanded awareness in which I am feeling an identity with that person rather than just empathy. Now a new phenomena has occurred. Now it is no longer that person's suffering. It becomes our suffering. If I quiet my mind and deepen my awareness, I come to the place where it is all part of one thing. Now the experience is that of my suffering or the suffering, and the suffering includes that person's pain and my heart, all of it. If I expand my awareness yet again, I am the space that surrounds the suffering. And within that space, there is the pain in the individual and the pain in my heart, very much like there are clouds within the sky. And so finally, I just want to share that during one of my earlier darker moments on that retreat, I was sitting in meditation and I had a vision. And by the way, just as a permission kind of thing, if a vision comes that's really strong, really has you, it's a visualization. Some of us have that. Go with it. Okay? Pat might not agree with me. I don't know. But I have been told from many, many teachers, and it's been a blessing to me to stay with my visions often. They really have things to teach you. So don't go off into fantasy land all the time. But if something's really gripping you, go for it. Stay with it. So my vision on this long retreat was, I had this vision of this gigantic woman, a mother, and this small mouse-like thing that was crawling up. So I became that giant woman. I felt giant. And there was a little mouse-like thing. I didn't know if it was a long retreat, so I didn't know if it was real or in my imagination kind of thing. But I kept feeling this thing crawling up, and it wanted to go to the top of my head. And I kept kind of pushing it away, pushing the vision away. I didn't want the mouse thing there. And finally, I just let it happen, and the mouse came. And when I let the mouse come, it came all the way up in the top of my head, and it curled up there, and it just wanted to rest. And I held it at the top of my head, and it just felt so sweet as I was meditating. And right after I walked to the meditation hall to listen to a talk. And right near the doorway, I'd never seen it before. I don't know how many years it's been there. I'd never seen it. It was this big statue of Kuan Yin, who's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And in all my years of meditating, I never noticed this. But in the very top of Kuan Yin's head, kind of nested there, is the Buddha. And so at that moment, I recognized love and compassion are bigger. They're the bigger thing. They hold our mindfulness. Kuan Yin is bigger than our mindfulness. She holds it. Okay. So I think I'm going to end there and just invite you just briefly to end into just a couple minutes of practice. So just taking a nice deep breath in, deep breath out. And here again, I'd like to invite you to place one hand or both on the heart, one hand on the heart, one hand on the belly, whatever feels good, to tap into the heart. Tap into your own good heart. And just notice whatever's here right now in the heart, tonight, this evening. Can you get a sense of being that kind, compassionate listener without judgment, without making anything wrong? You might even hear the words, I will not abandon you. Can you say that to your heart in some way? I'm right here. I'm listening. I'm listening. You might, as you're listening, ask your feelings what your heart needs. And listen. What do you need? What do you need? I'm listening. Notice if there's any fixing involved and let that go. Come back to the heart. Listen. Just listen. Finally, just remembering these words from Rumi. Don't turn away. Don't turn away. Keep your gaze on the bandaged place. That is where the light enters you. That is where the light enters you.